calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
Greetings from coast to coast. This is the Tom Hartman Program, and once again, Tom is off today. I'm Peter B. Collins, joining you from San Francisco. As you probably know, Tom Hartman lost his father over the past weekend, and he was buried, Carl Hartman, yesterday in Michigan. And Tom is making the long journey back to Portland, and he expects to be back on the air tomorrow with us here on the Tom Hartman Program. All of us share the loss and share our sympathy with Tom and his family at this difficult time. But I'm here to take care of business. We've got a lot to talk about on the program today. Coming up next hour, we're going to talk to writer Brenda Peterson and get an update on the international conference that was held on whaling. This came at the suggestion of a listener who sent me some information after Monday's program. Also on the show today, Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink for Peace, will join us to talk about an important hunger strike that is being launched on July 4th, and a rotating cast of important people will be right there at the White House, taking a day off from food, and trying to send an important message to the president and the American people. Medea Benjamin will join us in our third hour today here on the Tom Hartman Program. But I'm delighted that the publisher of one of my favorite magazines is going to join us right now, and I'm looking at the centerfold in the current issue. And I'm sorry if you're expecting Hef or Gooch or somebody like that, but we're going to talk with Katrina Vandenhoevel from The Nation, one of my favorite magazines. Hello, Katrina.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
I'm fine. Thanks for joining us today. And thank you for publishing the 10th anniversary gatefold display, which helps us understand what you call the national entertainment state and I call the corporate media.
Yeah, no, Peter, I mean, I love when you mentioned, you know, 10 years ago, The Nation, which has been around since 1865, committed to an independent free media, published its first centerfold. And it was sort of a joke, but it wasn't a joke, because that centerfold in 1996 showed the tentacles of four colossal conglomerates that were increasingly dominant, determining how America got their news. Mm-hmm. Now, we come here to this, you know, this centerfold, and we have a few more. I mean, you know, we're not seven, but I mean, now we're at seven. And but the danger of consolidation and the impact on media and our democracy remains very troubling, as you know. On the other hand, this issue, there is some optimism expressed by people like Marcos of Daily Kos or Robert Greenwald, a very mm-hmm. entrepreneurial, enterprising documentary filmmaker. Some of your listeners may know of Outfoxed or
well,
the Walmart.
Well, we sure know
film.
About Robert Greenwald, yeah.
Yeah, so there is a conflicted sense that we're at a kind of turning point in the media, but that we need to keep fighting some of these battles, both about consolidation and, of course, the issue of the net, the Internet, and the danger that these big media conglomerates may well colonize what so many of us hope will set us free.
And Katrina Vandenhoevel, let's just focus on two of the conglomerates that are featured in this gatefold. First up, General Electric. Now, most people know that GE owns the NBC television network. They probably don't know that it also owns Telemundo, which is one of the fastest-growing Spanish-language television networks. They have the partnership with MSNBC. It hasn't gone that well with Microsoft, but that continues.
That's to say the
and,
least.
Of course, what infuses a lot of the programming, including so-called news content that you see on the GE outlets, also reflects their investments in aircraft engines, in financial services, oil and gas, turbo machinery. GE is a conglomerate in the true meaning of that word, and their interests are reflected in their coverage. Would you agree?
I would agree that we're not seeing a lot, you know, about the dangers of nuclear power, considering that NBC's owner, General Electric, you know, has a more than passing interest in the development and operation of nuclear power plants. I think what's really distressing, Peter, is that the you know news in the public interest is such a tiny cog in so many of these multinational corporations. And my hope, and again, your listeners hope they know that, you know, we lay out a 10-point plan for media democracy as part of this centerfold, and mm-hmm. ask people to really pay attention to some of the work they could do in their community and working with organizations who care about things like media ownership and minority ownership and privacy and network neutrality, which we talked about. But those are issues that we all have to be aware of and be aware of who owns what we're viewing. As you said, you know, there's no question that, you know, one reason we live with what I call a downsized politics of excluded alternatives is that, you know, we're not getting on our TV screens and on our radios, except for you, and some radio going on in America today, which is good, but we're not getting the full range of views in this, you know, diverse and great land, and that's a disservice to people. And let's be honest, you know, probably 80% of Americans still get basic news from television and radio. The internet is coming up, but we need to work on that to open up the system. And I think alternative forms of ownership will be something more and more people are going to think about. And
you referenced net neutrality. There's a setback in the Senate yesterday. The battle isn't over, but we really need to fight hard to preserve the level playing field on the internet as it exists today.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we think so many, and I, you know, Marcos, who's in the issue, you know, listen, I think what the internet has done is become a kind of public square, and that's exciting. But you know, there are many people who think the internet's going to set us free, as I said, and I think we have to pay attention to how the internet is evolving. And as I said earlier, the vast frontiers of new media are being colonized by big players of old media, and they won, you know, they've won some rounds in that net neutrality fight. So we, you know, people, citizens need to pay attention and push their legislators and representatives to represent them. Otherwise, you know, America is, you know, this isn't new to your listeners, America isn't doing too well on some of the basic metrics of democracy. And one metric is sort of media and access to media and, you know, free media. And if we have a kind of redlining of the internet where people are traveling on like a fast speed highway and others are on an old dirt road, it's going to contribute to even more inequality in this country.
Indeed. We're talking with Katrina Vandenhoevel. She's the publisher of The Nation. We're talking about their current edition, which includes this very powerful map, a centerfold of the corporate media in this country. Let's next turn to the News Corporation. That's Rupert Murdoch's company. And their connection with internet sites like MySpace, which is a very fast-growing, popular site among young people. And a lot of people think that it's actually being used, that the reason Murdoch bought it is for market research to develop the next round of awful reality television shows.
Well, you know, what's interesting about MySpace, we wrote about this at The Nation, is, you know, in the great immigrant rights protest marches in the last months, MySpace was one of the galvanizing forums for people to organize protests around that brought people into the streets. So the irony of that is Rupert Murdoch has been a great contributor to the immigrant rights protests. But yes, no, I think, you know, Murdoch has, he's a brilliant man, and you don't have to be a good man to be a brilliant man, but he understands what he's doing by buying up these things like MySpace. And the dumbing down of television, and listen, I watch a fair share of reality TV, but the dumbing down is a real problem. In a country where, you know, I guarantee you more people know, you know, the name Taylor Hicks than the Supreme Court judge who may have just made the deciding vote on, you know, issues affecting our democracy. So Fox, Murdoch, you know, what Murdoch respects is green. And I'm not talking Green Party, I'm talking money.
Right.
So he has, you know, he has O'Reilly out there spinning, and he has MySpace, which, as again I said, you know, it's like an organizer in these protest marches, and he's just happy to make money. The New York Post, I have to say, in our city of New York, is not a is an ugly phenomenon.
Yes, it is. Now, Katrina Vandenhoevel, what do you think about the way Murdoch pulled punches and caved in to the Chinese, and he censors both internet and satellite television traffic going into China? Is this the is this what we're going to see in the United States in years to come?
Well, we've seen the power of big corporations. They're countries. They're countries, Peter. I mean, they do what they wish. There's very little. There's not enough oversight. And you see that the what I said earlier about the impact of green. That's what Murdoch cares about. He's not in there to speak about truth, justice, and democracy or human rights. So he's complicit with a Chinese government that is not respectful of those issues. But, you know, I do think, one thing I care a lot about, Peter, in these last, not just days, but in the last months, and we see it coming to a head in these last days, is, you know, we better attend to our own democracy at home and not worry so much about exporting it. I mean, we've tried to export democracy so extensively that it's a commodity depleted at home, and at the moment we face an administration which is at war.
Katrina, we're going to take a break and return in just a moment. Katrina Vandenhoevel, publisher of The Nation. If you'd like to talk with her, get on the line now, 866-440-TOM. I'm Peter B. Collins on the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We continue on the Tom Hartman radio program. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco, sitting in for Tom again today. He'll be back with you tomorrow. Lines are open if you'd like to talk with us. Our guest, Katrina Vandenhoevel, with us for the rest of this segment. 866-440-THON. That's 866-440-8466. Katrina, we've got this phony firestorm created by the administration, pushing back on the New York Times, singling them out despite the fact that other media outlets publish this information about the surveillance of international banking transactions. And I think you really nailed it in your blog on thenation.com, I think posted yesterday. You said, and so this administration and its allies are once again doing what they do best, labeling those they believe are interfering with their ability to escape accountability and oversight as disgraceful, treasonous, and damaging. Right pejoratives, wrong targets.
Yeah, no, I think, Peter, this is what we're seeing with the threats to prosecute the New York Times. And today, it's now moved to the Congress with Republicans introducing a resolution, it appears, not only to prosecute or condemn the New York Times, but also introducing language that infringes on the First Amendment. I think we're seeing a continuation of this administration's undeclared war on the media and an effort to clear space from any oversight or accountability of an executive power run amok. And I really do believe this story, we're learning more and more, first of all, that many counterterrorism experts believe there's really, you know, this story has not in any sense damaged national security. And in fact, Peter King held hearings on financial transactions relating to terrorism. And I think, we're seeing that the balance between security and liberty, which we all care about, is so radically off balance because of an administration that doesn't brook any oversight, and the Congress has essentially abandoned oversight. So I fear that blame the media, the scapegoating, is now going to be the next rove strategy in this election.
Well, and they're proposing a kind of inappropriate oversight. We've got J.D. Hayworth, a brilliant visionary guy, who is proposing that the New York Times lose its press pass to Capitol Hill.
It's so over the limits that it's astonishing. I mean, it is staggering. And, you know, who will stand up? It's not just the First Amendment, but it's the fundamental right of you know, the need for a free press is a cornerstone of our democracy. It seems to me that many of these right-wing pundits who are frothing don't seem to appreciate that we, the American people, need to have a free press to check the excesses of government. And that, think about what, you know, what we've learned as a result of some rigorous, vigorous reporting, which, by the way, if we had had that kind of reporting in the run-up to war in Iraq, perhaps we wouldn't be in the greatest debacle of American foreign policy in many decades. So I think people may have lost sight of the value of a free press and the danger of invoking national security as a cover is going to do harm to the public interest. I mean, this is not new, Peter, either. I mean, if people remember in Watergate, Richard Nixon's apologists tried to suggest that the media, particularly the Washington Post, was savaging the president unfairly, and the same thing happened, you know, with other instances where administration wants to cover up its backside more than national security.
Mm-hmm. Katrina, I want to single you out for praise for a moment, and I hope you won't blush too much, but I really appreciate that you go right into the lion's den. There you were just the other night back on Scarborough Country. I've seen you over on the Fox News Channel, and I appreciate that you put aside perhaps maybe some of your personal reticence and really confront these people and help get a progressive message out, because all too often we see these panels of people on these cable shout shows where we have a person who is from the right and a person from the far right, and that's considered balance.
Hey, I thank you. I'm grateful for your words. And I do think that, you know, all of us who have a point of view which, you know, is not only not represented or too little represented in what passes, you know, for our media debate and conversation, that there's a kind of obligation. And I tell you, I do get hate mail. I got a really ugly voicemail the other day, really ugly. But I do get emails from people around the country, all over the country, thanking me for speaking up. And in these last months, from people self-identified as conservatives, because this administration isn't a conservative administration. It's extremist, rolling back, right, all of the kind of safeguards which true conservatives believe in. So, I try to go out and say my piece. And I'll tell you, sometimes your blood gets going. So you sort
I'll
of...
bet. just about 30 seconds remaining, Katrina VandenHeuvel. Do you think that this pushback from the administration is to try to intimidate the media to prevent disclosure of an even bigger spying program? That's one of my theories.
Well, I think that the bigger story was, of course, the warrantless wiretapping, the domestic surveillance story, and it may have been, and I don't want to over-personalize this, but we may have seen this campaign, this attack, demonization of the media earlier around that story if Karl Rove had not been under the threat of indictment. I do think there's a correlation between Mr. Rove being unleashed and using this tactic, blame the media. It is so much part of his strategy. What is surprising to me is how they've ratcheted it up so that it's not just surrogates like Peter King or Hayworth, but you have the actual president and vice president using this tactic.
It's disgraceful. Thank you very much, Katrina VandenHeuvel. Thanks for your work, and we'll talk to you again.
Thank you.
She's the publisher of The Nation magazine. You should read it every week because they print it every week. Coming up next, we go to the phones and talk to you at 866-440-THOM. I'm Peter B. Collins here on the Tom Hartman Program.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom Hartman today. Warning to the people in the city of Memphis, W is on the way, and he's bringing the Japanese Prime Minister. Somebody call Elvis.
Call Elvis. Call Elvis. We're on the way. We'll leave the building. I'm going to get to the phone. Call Elvis. We're on the way.
Yes, it turns out that the Prime Minister of Japan, Mr. Koizumi, is a big fan of Elvis. And as his reward for supporting Bush in the war in Iraq, he gets his own personal tour of Graceland. We're taking your calls here on the Tom Hartman Program, 866-440-THOM. That's 866-440-8466. And as I mentioned to Katrina VandenHeuvel just a couple of minutes ago, I believe that the reason the Bush administration is targeting the media right now is that there is more out there that they do not want disclosed. Russell Tice is a whistleblower who has gone public, and he can't tell us what he knows. But what he has said is that there is much more to the surveillance activities of this administration, and the implication is, and I can only take it as an implication so far, that you and I are under far more scrutiny than we even suspect today. Even after the revelations of the NSA eavesdropping program when Al-Qaeda calls, even after the disclosure that they're diving through our telephone records, data mining them for information without probable cause as required by the Fourth Amendment, and we know that most email traffic is subject to inspection, keywords can be searched for, and so we have lost an incredible amount of our privacy. And the revelations about the banking transactions being examined are not a surprise to Al-Qaeda or to anybody else, including the banking industry around the world. So I think these are crocodile tears, and it's a phony firestorm coming out of the White House, and I can only suspect that they feel there's something far more damaging, and they're trying to intimidate the media to prevent that from coming out. Let me know your theory. 866-440-TOM. We go first to Dick in Seattle, listening on KPTK. Hello, Dick.
Good morning, Peter. You know, I have to take exception first to Katrina's suggestion that the U.S. has ever worked to create true democracy since World War II abroad. You know, maybe oligarchic plutocracies, you know. But I really wanted to ask her if the Nation magazine still believes the election frauds of 2000 and 2004 that were affected by electronic voting machines that we know were created by Republican partisans. I wanted to ask her if they still believe this was just conspiracy theories, which David Corn stated in The Nation. And you know, this sort of political correctness, I'm afraid, represents a right-of-center corporate media influence. And I was hoping that with this latest report, they would come out strong against the electronic voting machines and the fraud they created.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me just speak for myself. I believe that the voting machines are a serious problem. I think there are security vulnerabilities, and I do believe that they have been hacked in the past, notably in Ohio in 2004. And, Dick, I'd also point out to you that in 2005, November, Ohio had a referendum election, and there were four or five measures on the ballot. And it's fascinating to see what happened, because there was Measure 1, which was supported by the Republican administration, and it passed by, I'm just picking a number here, but I believe it was 53-point-something%. Well, a pre-election poll conducted by the Columbus Dispatch just 4 days before the election predicted that it would pass by almost precisely that margin. And that same poll identified three or four other ballot measures that were anti-Republican. One was a redistricting measure. One was a campaign finance rollback of the new looser regulations that had been passed by the Republican legislature. Well, measures like that went down in a margin that was far different from the pre-election polling.
They
not within a point or two, but like 30 points off. And there is a deep suspicion that that election was hacked and that the results were manipulated, almost flipped on their proverbial rear.
Yeah.
So I take the issues very seriously. And one interesting development recently is that Congresswoman Jan Schakowsky of Chicago gave a speech in Washington where she embraced the findings of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. regarding the stolen election in Ohio in 2004. She went on to apologize to people like you and my friend Brad Friedman, who runs BradBlog and focuses almost exclusively on election integrity issues, black box voting, and others. She offered an apology, saying she's disappointed with herself for not recognizing these issues earlier. So we are making some progress there, Dick, but I share your deep concern about it. Thanks for the call today. Another caller from Seattle. It's John. Welcome to the program. I'm Peter B. Collins. Hi, John.
Hello. The thing I want to talk about or complain about is that all kinds of people are all getting hot and bothered about what the Republicans are doing. The problem I see, there's another side to it, and I can give one example. The other side is that nobody's complaining about what the Democrats are not doing to run decent elections, to stay united.
Mm-hmm.
The Republicans have simple concepts. Everybody from the president on down talks about it. It's always say the same thing. You know where they stand. When the Democrats talk about something, you have six or seven different people saying six or seven different things. They all talk about different things. And when elections come along, they say, well, what do the Democrats stand for? They say, we don't know. I mean, Senator Clinton gave a little speech last week on the Senate floor about the administration in Iraq, and I listened to it twice, and I didn't understand what she was talking about.
Well, she has a very muddled position, and
she
seems intent on keeping it that way.
Right.
Well, John, I share your concern, and I just want to be clear that Tom Hartman and I share something, and that is that we don't pull punches as progressive talk show hosts, and we are free to criticize Democrats when they don't perform up to our expectations or when they do crazy things like support the flag-burning amendment. Senator Feinstein, my senior senator from California, is such a disappointment when she joins the pandering right wing on an issue like that. It's really unforgivable, and it is one of those issues that tends to divide the Democratic Party. And it's used effectively by the Republicans to wedge divisions in the Democratic Party. And I agree with you that we need some discipline, we need some common themes and unity. And the unfortunate thing is that the power in the party, in my view, is residing with the people who have the money and the corporate contacts. And that boils down to the DLC, the Democratic Leadership Council. And they have pushed in a much more centrist, pro-corporate thrust, which I think is wrong-headed for the Democratic Party. And so there is a struggle underway. There's a new magazine, webzine, called The Democratic Strategist. Google it and take a look. These are people who are trying to bridge between the different elements of the Democratic Party to try to build the kind of unity that you're talking about. Unfortunately, I think that when unity develops, compromise is necessary, and the DLC types want to marginalize progressives and people who have strong sentiments and philosophies and policies, as opposed to just the straddle approach of the DLC. And so I think that this year is pivotal for the Democratic Party as we try to get a grip on what the party stands for and who its leaders are and who can speak with an authoritative voice for Democrats nationwide. John, thanks a lot for your call today. Now I want to jump to Healdsburg, California, where Tom's on the line. Hello, Tom. It's Peter B. How are you today?
I'm fine, Peter. You're familiar with Dr. Bill, I'm sure. Dr. Bill.
Well,
Wattenberg.
For the benefit of our listeners who don't hear him on the West Coast, Dr. Bill Wattenberg is a professor in the UC system, and he hosts a radio show on a San Francisco station on Saturday and Sunday nights. And he used to do just kind of Mr. Fix-It stuff. He's a brilliant mechanical engineer or something like that. And you could call him and talk about toilets and talk about airplanes. But in the last few years, he's gone hard right. And he spews a lot of vitriol about people who don't support the Bush administration.
Yes. Okay, well, he actually, his PhD is in physics. And so he's very pro nuclear power, and that which is, you know, I must say, I think even my hands are a bit up in the air about that. I think there is some thought to be given about that may have some pertinence. But my main point
is, Tom, be clear there. Are you saying that you can support building new nuclear power plants in this country?
No, I still think it's viable to contemplate. I do think that it could be much safer than what it is now. I certainly support, as you well know, that Bill Wattenberg does not, any alternatives. I mean, even something that will bring up, like as you well know, the new project under the Golden Gate Bridge, where they will take advantage of the tides, and mm-hmm. and that will.
The proposal is to put some turbines down there that would generate electricity as the tide flows in and out.
Exactly, for roughly 30,000 households. And that's a lot. But see, when you speak to someone like Bill Wattenberg, he said, "Oh, what'll that cost? That'll cost a tremendous amount." And that's only like as he puts it. And I'll put this nicely because it's a point that he always makes is, you know, if you want to tinkle into the Mississippi River to try to change its flow, what good's that going to do? Well, I think 5% here, 5% there, 5% in other places are very important. And he,
mm-hmm.
but my point to you is, Peter, I know there are a lot of listeners in your area. I have to stream Tom Hartman's show in Healdsburg.
Mm-hmm.
I can't get it. KSRO in Santa Rosa doesn't carry it anymore. And but anyway, there are a lot of listeners I know from Seattle and the Portland area. So,
right.
So what can people do? You know how difficult it is to talk to him because he's a brute.
Yeah, I would just turn off your radio until he's finished.
Oh, well, I do.
That's one way to deal with it. Tom, I'm up against a break here. Thanks for your call today. More calls in a moment at 866-440-8466. I'm Peter B. Collins on the Tom Hartman Program. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. And the Tom Hartman Program continues. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco, sitting in for Tom again today. We've got lines available if you'd like to talk with us at 866-440-TOM, 866-440-8466. The Abramoff scandal has nailed another one. A gentleman named Stilwell, Roger Stilwell, the desk officer for the Mariana Islands at the U.S. Department of Interior, has pled guilty to accepting gifts that he didn't report, gifts from Jack Abramoff. So he joins Abramoff, Michael Scanlon, Tony Rudy, Neil Volz, and Adam Kadan as having pled guilty, and then there's David Safavian, who was convicted last week. And this is a web of individuals that will continue to expand. Also, the Supreme Court announced this morning a rebuke of President George W. Bush. They ruled that Bush overstepped his authority in ordering military war crimes trials for Guantanamo Bay detainees. This is a major victory for the folks at the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. Michael Ratner and his colleagues have worked hard to protect the interests of the detainees there, and they are our interests, after all. This is the case of Salim Hamdan, a Yemeni who had worked as a bodyguard and a driver for Osama bin Laden. He spent 4 years in the brig there at Guantanamo Bay and was one of the handful of people who's actually been proposed for one of these tribunals. And in a 5-3 decision, the Supreme Court rejected that. And it was a recusal for Chief Justice John Roberts because, as you may recall, just a few days before they recruited him for the Supreme Court, he had ruled in favor of the Bush administration as an appeals court judge in Washington, D.C. And while we're talking about white, wacky guys, wacky white guys in black robes...
Hear ye! Hear ye! The court's in session. The court's in session. Now, here come the judge. Here come the judge.
Here come the judge!
Have you heard the case of Donald Thompson? He spent 23 years as a judge in Bristow, Oklahoma... And he is now on trial for indecent exposure in his own courtroom. The charge is that he used a penis pump on himself to pleasure himself while he was on the bench presiding over trial. The 59-year-old jurist is charged with 4 counts of indecent exposure. And one of the court reporters said, "Ick!" I looked over and I heard this kind of weird noise, and I noticed this strange look on the judge's face. And the judge says it was only a gag gift and he never actually used it. I can't wait till that case gets up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Yeah. Jason in Grand Rapids, you're next here on the Tom Hartman Program. This is Peter B. How are you?
Yes. Great. First of all, I'd like to send my condolences and prayers out to Tom and his family for their loss. And, hopefully a lot of listeners are doing the same.
Thank you for that.
Okay. First of all, people should basically stop watching so much TV and just start paying attention to, like, other forms of media, other outlets. because I think the fact that people aren't able to decipher what Democrats are about is because democracy and the exchange is not like some prepackaged commercial commodity. So people have to stop looking at it that way. All the messages are not going to be the same. You know, everybody that you meet has a different idea about things, and the same is for politicians, which, you know, gives us the diversity of our democracy. Secondly, this conspiracy theory about the election theft for the last two national elections, it's not like some kind of conspiracy nut theory, or, you know, the way they like to term it, because the actual fact is that election theft is growing. It's not getting any less. Mm-hmm. And with the electronic voting machines and the news that's just come out about the ability to get in and tamper with these electronic voting machines is, you know, ample evidence. You know, plus,
well, and it's not just the touchscreen machines. It's the scanners that tabulate votes from optical scanners, from the kind of ballot where you fill in the blank.
Right. And then we have optical scanners here in Michigan. So, mm-hmm. you know, I'm wondering if that, you know, might be part of that problem as well. But, you know, a way to get around that is for people just to get active. You know, particularly people in Ohio. I just talked to a lady from Ohio and, you know, recommended that she get active and start, you know, doing some kind of networking. But, mm-hmm. you know, people around the country, to get people to get registered and to get their registrations updated.
Well, and to show up to vote, we had a 30% turnout for the California primary. In Virginia, it was less than 4%. Now,
right.
that's permitting minority rule.
Right.
That is saying, I don't care. And we've got to start right there, Jason. Yes,
people,
the machines are vulnerable, and we have to be worried about security, but we also have to get people to actually show up and vote. And the right has been doing a better job than the left at that over the last few cycles. Thanks for your call from Grand Rapids today. Well, thank you for joining us this hour on the Tom Hartman Program. We're going to continue next hour, talk about the whaling convention and efforts to rein in Japan's whaling operations. We'll take more of your calls, too. Right here on the Tom Hartman Program, I'm Peter B. Collins.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
Welcome to this edition of the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom. And Tom will be back with us tomorrow. He expects to be on the air as usual. He is one of the hardest working people in progressive talk radio, and he took a few days off to tend to family matters after the death of his father. And he's on his way back to Portland, Oregon, his home base, where he'll be back on the air tomorrow, by all accounts. And he expects to be on early next week, too. So if you want to send a note of condolence, go to the TomHartman.com website and go to forums. And from there, you can just click in and find the thread to drop a note to Tom. And I'm sure he would appreciate hearing from you. Our lines are open if you'd like to join us. We'll go back to the phones here shortly at 866-440-TOM, 866-440-8466. And I have to tell you that one of the joys of hosting a radio talk show is that smart people call in, smart people email, and share views and information with you. And I actually learn a lot from listeners. And I want to acknowledge somebody who sent an unsigned email from the account Sundbergs on Whidbey Island. And Whidbey Island, of course, one of the beautiful islands off the coast of Washington State, Seattle. And this individual sent me a note because on Monday's program, someone had called in and talked about the conference on whaling that had occurred in the Caribbean islands of Nevis and St. Kitts just a few weeks ago, and Japan's sorry record on whaling. And this listener sent me some information which led me to our guest of this moment, Brenda Peterson. She is a novelist, a nature writer, a whale lover, And she is known for her novels River of Light, Becoming the Enemy, and Duck and Cover. And she's written extensively, including a piece that was in the Seattle Times recently. Brenda Peterson, welcome to the Tom Hartman program today. I'm Peter B.
Thank you very much, Peter.
Tell me a little bit about your impressions of this whaling conference that occurred in the Caribbean recently, and in particular the posture of Japan, which continues to want to maintain its whaling industry despite the serious lack of consumer interest in whale products.
Exactly. You know, I wrote in my op-ed for the Seattle Times that Japan's position on the whale hunt is bewildering to many of us who so appreciate Japanese culture. I've been there as a writer, and I've lectured there and found the Japanese to be some of the most courteous and far-sighted of cultures that I've visited. For example, they have fuel emissions cars on the market. They have a leadership in animation. So then why does their whaling commission, against all international outrage, continue to kill 1,000 whales a year, most of which meat now ends up in surplus warehouses and even in Japanese dog food? So why are the Japanese risking international contempt and outrage to do this? And this article that I wrote kind of looks into that and wonders if perhaps it might have something to do more with the past than with the future. I actually have a personal opinion, having talked to many Japanese friends and students, that this whaling might be related to a lost war, World War II. It might be related to the fact that they lost their military. And it might be related to the fact that we dropped a nuclear bomb on Hiroshima and Nagasaki and have not yet ever apologized. And one of my positions was, what if we went to the International Whaling Commission and the U.S. Government actually said, we finally grieve with you and apologize for what happened in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Would that then stop the scapegoating of this other culture of whales that seems so much in the kind of trigger of the Japanese whaling industry?
Well, Brenda, the Prime Minister of Japan is in Washington today for meetings with our president at the White House, Prime Minister Koizumi.
Yes.
And they're going to fly to Memphis for a tour of Graceland. That's Koizumi's payback for supporting Bush on the war in Iraq. I just don't imagine that even on Air Force One, they would have a moment to either talk about whaling or that Bush would have any introspection to offer the kind of apology to the Japanese that you just described.
It's the lack of depth and philosophical intelligence in our government that we don't even have these kinds of conversations, except on Air America and Tom Hartman and certain newspapers and books. The dialogue that we need to be having right now with Japan is not the deeply superficial dialogue of Graceland. It's the dialogue about what is happening in this world where the oceans are so endangered. Our scientists are warning us about global warming. Our marine biologists are telling us our coral reefs are in trouble and our whales are in trouble. What is going on in our governments that they cannot talk about the future of the oceans, which are the womb of our entire civilization?
We're talking with Brenda Peterson here on the Tom Hartman program. And Brenda, an interesting report from the San Francisco Chronicle just 2 days ago, citing scientists who conduct whale population counts near San Luis Obispo along the California coastline every year.
Yes.
And they showed that there is a little bit of an encouraging sign, because 2005 was not quite the lowest year on record, but it was disappointing. 945 new baby whales were identified. This year it's up to 1,020. And scientists are speculating that there's actually a short-term benefit caused by global warming and the climate change in the northern areas that the whales migrate to. And they're finding a little bit more nutrients that they have to go further north for. But at the moment, I guess the melting polar ice cap is actually producing some food supplies, and the whale population is at least up a little bit from last year. But the number of only 1,020, and you just said that Japan is slaughtering 1,000 a year, so that's not a net gain.
Well, thank you for that fascinating info. I hadn't heard that yet. The gray whales are protected under the whaling ban that the IWC just criticized several weeks ago with the Japan-led coalition. Now, Japan has been hunting minke whales and hunting humpback whales and birdies whales, but they haven't yet hunted gray whales. Now, I wrote about this for the National Geographic book that I wrote with Linda Hogan on the gray whale, and they have recovered because of the whaling ban. In fact, one of the things I wanted to tell your listeners was that those whales in the Baja birthing lagoons are protected for 70 years since this whaling ban in 1986. And they have been exhibiting what we call the friendly whale syndrome, scientists call it that, in which the mothers of newborn calves in these very pristine waters will bring their calves up to the little skiffs with the people in them. And I've never seen this in all the years I've been down there, but until last year, they are actually lifting their babies up eye level with the people in the boats, as if to say, here is our next generation, can you protect them? And when you see the eye of a whale, dark, unblinking, benevolent, looking at you, it's as if you're staring into a portal of another kind of intelligence in the oceans that we desperately need to learn from and not slaughter. We need to reach out to these whales with our hands and reward such trust interspecies and not with our harpoons.
And Brenda Peterson, in the op-ed that you wrote for the Seattle Times, you suggested that Japan could limit any economic damage from cutbacks on whaling by converting to whale watching. And
exactly.
We have pretty thriving industries along the Pacific coastline here in the United States of whale watching boats and tours and groups that go out.
Yes, and that's been proven by the dolphin fishermen on one side of this island where they have been slaughtering dolphins for generations. And the outcry was so intense that now some of the very same dolphin fishermen who were slaughtering dolphins are taking dolphin watches out and making a very good income because, unbeknownst to the Japanese government, only 1% of Japanese people eat whale meat. Only 1%. So the other 99% are engaged in conservation, in whale watching, in dolphin watching. We had two Japanese women on our last Baja trip who taught us the song Sakura, which is a cherry blossom festival song. And it was very interesting because I wrote about that. And at the same time they had taught me that, that same year, a gray whale, a very solitary gray whale, showed up in Tokyo Harbor. And the whole harbor was crowded with Japanese citizens welcoming the gray whale. So this is a schizophrenia. It's really the old mind of the Japanese generation who lost the war that's leading this kind of fight and this hunt.
Very interesting. And Brenda, I have a little sound here of whales recorded underwater.
Those are humpbacks.
And you can identify them as humpbacks?
Humpback whales are the ones who sing those beautiful lullabies. And in fact, these humpbacks that the Japanese intend to kill are known to sing very much in patterns that we would recognize acoustically as...
Brenda Peterson, thanks for joining us on the Tom Hartman program. I'm Peter B.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Well, I got a friend named Whiskey Sam. He was my boony rat buddy for a year and now. He said, I think my country got a little off track. Took him 25 years to welcome me back. But it's better than not coming back at all. Many a good man I saw fall. And even now, every time I dream, I hear the men and the monkeys in the jungle scream.
That's the late, great Johnny Cash here on the Tom Hartman program. I'm Peter B. Collins sitting in for Tom again today. And your calls are welcome right now. Lines are open at 866-440-THOM. That's 866-440-8466. You can comment on any subject from any viewpoint and call me from anywhere in these United States. Dave in Eureka, thanks for holding on. You're on the air.
Hey, Peter. We get exposed to a great deal of reality by you and by Tom, and that's not supposed to be happening in today's America. And, you know, I am of the belief, as you know, that we have a government that is corrupt beyond comprehension. It's very difficult to recognize the magnitude of what they do to us, mistreatment of the people. It's an outrage beyond belief. And
It is, and the corporate agenda is really moving along swimmingly. This net neutrality vote yesterday in the Senate committee is just another example that the interests of the corporate donors to the one-party rule in Washington are having their way with this. And, the K Street Project is right out in the open. And there was Tom DeLay on TV last night gloating over the Supreme Court decision, of course, that came from the Bush-packed Supreme Court, upholding the political gerrymandering of those districts in Texas. So you are correct. The public interest is given short shrift in virtually everything that this administration does.
Because of what they are, because of who they are, they need to cheat in every way they can. Election fraud is what gets them in power. Election fraud is how they intend to stay in power. And spying on the people is essential because so many people that become aware of what they're all about become an annoyance, a threat, and so they need to be monitoring those who would. Free speech is not something they can tolerate and be what they are.
Well, and it's interesting, you're correct, but they maintain the illusion of free speech. And, you know, they talk about it as an idealized goal for the people of Iraq. But at the same time, they are diminishing free speech opportunities and privacy rights of every American citizen. And people appear to be oblivious in large degree, and that's what really scares me, Dave.
I know.
It's one thing for them to be doing it. It's another thing for us to be taking it.
Deceit, fraud, embezzlement, take advantage, exploit, and murder. We're not in Iraq for any noble purpose whatsoever. We're there for the profits of Halliburton and the little Carlyle group, and they are raping the treasury and no regard for the harm that they're doing.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful to have people like yourself and Tom to help us to see reality.
Well, and I appreciate what you do, Dave. Thanks for the call today. Lynn in Philadelphia, thank you for holding. You're next on the Tom Hartman program. This is Peter B.
Yes, I'm Lynn Landis. I feel a little guilty for calling in, but the show is always so interesting, and I'm a freelance journalist who writes about
the voting. Well, I've spoken to you before, Lynn Landis.
Okay. It's such an excellent show. One thing I wanted to point out is the issue of vote of these electronic machines always seems to be framed in terms of hacking, and I would like your listeners to think of it in the true sense is it's the fix is in. It's inside fixing of races with these voting machines, not outside hacking. That would be probably a rather remote risk. But
I understand your point. And,
yeah.
And to that point, I read a lengthy piece, and I thank again a listener who emailed it to me, about the husband and wife team, Tom Noe and his wife in Ohio. Noe, a crony of Governor Taft, was running the election system in Lucas County, that's Toledo. Then he stepped aside and his wife took over. And they used various techniques to suppress votes, limit participation, and outright steal elections. And they got big hugs and blessings and a lot of public acknowledgement from George W. Bush after the Ohio election was sealed at the end of 2004.
Yeah, and really to... In my mind, the only answer for this situation, if people want to do something, is to organize and make their votes public. Somehow, you know, organize into, single organizations or send the candidates a card saying, hey, I voted for you and this is my name and address. Somehow we have to get rid of this idea that secrecy is a good thing in voting.
Lynn, what about the idea of an independent exit polling entity? Instead of having the networks or anybody else do it, if we had Common Cause or the League of Women Voters conduct the exit polls, we would have a baseline to evaluate the election results against.
It's not real evidence. It's not direct evidence of anything. So what we need is affidavits. We need real evidence. We need people signing. And if you think about it, stockholders, when they vote publicly. And I think that's the standard we should be following.
Lynn, I'm up against a break. Thanks for joining me today, and I appreciate your work. We'll continue in a moment. Grab a line, 866-440-TOM, right here on the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins in San Francisco, sitting in for Tom again today. And we're taking your calls at 866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466, toll free. You can drop me an email, peter@peterbcollins.com. And at my website, you can get information on my daily radio show on the West Coast and also links to our archives. So peterbcollins.com if you're so inclined. Well, it didn't come as a huge surprise to me that the Republican-dominated Supreme Court would embrace Tom DeLay's mid-decade gerrymandering of districts for the House in the great state of Texas. And there was Tommy, oh yeah, the hammer, the retired pest control expert, on Hardball last night, gloating over this Supreme Court decision. And it really is all political, because in writing for the majority, Justice Anthony Kennedy said that state lawmakers who remapped Texas were not motivated solely by politics. Now, I'm sorry, I have to be blunt, that's BS. Tom DeLay was very upfront that the whole thing was about politics. And he is now standing trial, or is about to, for allegedly laundering money from federal campaigns into the Texas campaigns in direct violation of Texas state law. And what he did is acknowledged by the Republicans in the great lengths that they went to. If you recall, there was great resistance from the Democrats to this attempt to redraw the maps mid-decade in Texas. And at one point, they even left the state to deny a quorum in the legislature so that this, remap couldn't be jammed through. So for Justice Kennedy to suggest that the lawmakers were not motivated solely by politics is just BS. He wrote, "The legislature does seem to have decided to redistrict with the sole purpose of achieving a Republican congressional majority. But partisan aims did not guide every line it drew." Well, what the hell are you talking about, Justice Kennedy? Partisan aims guided the thrust of the whole operation. And to suggest that because one line or 10 lines were drawn without partisan considerations, and therefore this is okay, that is illogical. And the weight of the evidence does not support the conclusion that you have drawn. So now, I ask you, listeners, is it time for the neener, neener, neener approach? Should Democratic states with Democratic governors and Democratic-controlled legislatures start to redraw their district maps in order to skew the whole plan and produce more Democrats in the House of Representatives? Is it time to play hardball, friends? I'd like to hear your thoughts on that. Jeff in Sacramento, listening on 1240 Talk City, KSAC, my favorite radio station in Sacramento. Hello, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter B. How are you?
I'm doing fine today. Thank you.
Yeah. The gerrymandering's already in California, so you guys don't have to worry about it.
Right, but there are other states where Democrats could seize this opportunity because the Supreme Court has ruled that political gerrymandering is okay as long as some of the lines were not drawn for purely partisan purposes. So most of them can be, just not all of them.
Peter, I said that facetiously because Democrats have gerrymandered California for decades, and you guys don't seem to care about that.
Actually, Jeff, what I care about right now is that the map that was drawn for California provided for full incumbent protection, not just Democrats, but every Republican seat is as safe as the Democratic seats.
I don't
approve of that, and I do support balanced redistricting in California.
But we tried that, and the Democrats prevented, and all the progressive radio stations talked against Arnold trying to do that. So, you know, I'm believing that that's not the case. That he like, in fact, even Doolittle tried to keep gerrymandering alive here in California, because in the effort to do that, they kept his seat safe, and so he can't be voted out. So it goes both ways. But in California, we have gerrymandering for decades, and the Democrats are the ones that are doing it. But I call on the subject about voting.
Jeff.
Yes.
Let me just acknowledge your point. You are right. The map that Phil Burton drew in the 1980s was political gerrymandering that benefited Democrats, including his little brother. So I don't pull punches here. You are correct. What I'm asking is, going forward, should Democrats adopt the hardball policies of Republicans and draw their maps with ruthless politics in mind and not any sense of balance or fairness to the other side?
I wouldn't like to see that, because in essence, I don't like gerrymandering on either side. But at the same time, overall, the country would lose, because it probably would be more red than blue, because there's more states that would be able to make it all red.
All right.
In California alone, I mean, I would say that even the majority is Democratic. There's a very close race, and if you take that into consideration with all the other states around us, you'll know that many of those states can easily gerrymandering to the right, and that wouldn't be good either, because they're not all of the greatest leaders.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But Jeff, thanks for joining us today. I got to move on. Got a bunch of callers on the board, and I want to be fair to everybody. Will in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, listening to WPTT. You're on the air on the Tom Hartman program.
Good morning, Mr. Collins.
Hello, Will.
How are you, buddy?
Good. And call me Peter. I reserve the Mr. thing for the arresting officer and the sentencing judge.
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor.
And I do not have a penis pump. I just want you to know.
Yes,
and
Your
I've never taken OxyContin ever, including before doing a radio talk show.
At least 250 times, right? Oh, God. Peter, first I would like to echo your sentiment about the black robes. I don't even want to go into it. I mean, I just get depressed with them. And there's no such thing as democracy anymore in our country. Jesus.
Well, we've lost a lot. I think it's not all lost, but we need to really pay attention and struggle to save it before they do give it all away.
But, Peter, my brother and I and my friends, we served in the military in the 60s. Okay? I just, look, I see no solution here. I would like to just see, in my own state here in Pennsylvania, where my vote counts for something, or in a national election where the popular vote does elect the president, not some nine robes, 1-0? Is that what the vote was?
No, it was 5-4.
Well, 1-0.
Okay.
Majority of one.
Yeah.
Peter, the reason I called, and by the way, you have a wonderful, wonderful radio man there in Dan, your producer.
Well, we should acknowledge Dan and Tim in the control room.
Oh, okay.
In our
today
in New York.
I'm sorry. I usually get Dan.
Uh-huh.
I think I'm Tim. Thank you for correcting me on that.
No. Tim's at the controls. Dan's answering the phone.
Okay. Peter.
Yeah.
That you brought up Building 7. I would please, if you could indulge us, because I know there's a lot of people. What went down on that?
Okay. So, I want to refer people to the website, WTC7.net. And there is a whole body of information there that you can examine for yourself. And it was put together by Jim Hoffman, who has now produced a new documentary film. And it's fundamentally this, that Building 7 at the World Trade Center crashed to the ground at 5:20 in the afternoon on 9/11. There had been a fire reported in the building, but it was not of any scope or threat that it could have caused a meltdown of the structure itself. And as Hoffman points out, the building came down with resistance equivalent to gravity, which is a way of saying that the structure itself offered no resistance as it came top down and essentially imploded into its own footprint. And it is gentleman, Jim Hoffman, describes this in detail and says that this is consistent with a demolition. And then in the documentary, he shows demolitions, for example, of a department store building, the Hudson's Building in downtown Detroit. And it was brought down pretty much within its own footprint by using demolition explosives. And he concludes, and I concur, that the physical evidence supports the notion that the World Trade Center Building Number 7 was brought down. And its owner, Larry Silverstein, was quoted on public radio or television as saying that he told them to go ahead and pull it. Well, pull it is a demolition term to launch the explosives, to fire them. And so, you know, we don't know exactly why this was done or how long it took them to plan it and, you know, build in the explosives in the building. But it's very clear that World Trade Center Building Number 7 did not just fall down.
Peter, before you run, the book from Hoffman or the documentary, I'd like to buy it, or is it going to be on TV or what?
Well, go to that website, WTC7.net.
That's the problem, Peter. I don't have a web.
Okay. Hold on, Will. We're going to get your address. I'll send you a copy of the documentary. More of your calls coming up in a moment. Peter B. Collins on the Tom Hartman Program.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I lived with them on Montague Street in a basement down the stairs. There was music in the cafes at night and revolution in the air. Hell, he started into dealing with slaves and something inside of him died. She had to sell everything she owned and froze up inside. And when it all came crashing down, I became with
little gone. Bob Dylan transition music. That's one of the many renditions of Tangled Up in Blue. One of the beauties of seeing Bob Dylan live is that he'll perform songs that you know in a completely different arrangement. And apparently the band has trouble keeping up with him, figuring out which one he's going to use on any given night. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom Hartman today here on the Tom Hartman Program. Let's go to Woodby Island, Washington, line 4. Rebecca is on the line. Hello, Rebecca. Welcome to our program.
Hi. I'm really glad you had that segment on earlier.
Well, thank you. Thank you for your input.
Yeah, I didn't sign it, I guess, because I was so busy copying, pasting in her article. But Brenda Peterson is really insightful, and I've heard her speak. One thing she didn't have a chance to mention that I think is really important is that the whales they're finding are toxic. You know, they concentrate PCBs and other toxic heavy metals.
Mm-hmm.
So when they do die and wash up on shore, often they just sink. But they have to bury them as toxic waste. And people who know anything about this won't eat them. Most people in Japan, of course, she said, won't touch it. They can't even unload it for school lunches or anything.
Well, and there are also large concentrations of mercury in many fish and sea-going mammals these days.
Right, right. And the whales apparently, because they're sort of at the top of the food chain, they're pretty much up there as the worst in terms of that. So they indicate what we have in our oceans, you know, these toxins that have gone in there for years that really we need to do some serious cleaning up of the oceans. And I wanted to mention a couple of organizations that I think are really wonderful that are helping with the situation in some very direct ways. Greenpeace is one. They go down to Antarctica where there's illegal whaling by the Japanese and do what they can to intervene. Another organization called Sea Shepherd. Captain Paul Watson is an incredible person. These can be, if anybody wants to find them online, it wouldn't be difficult at all.
Okay.
And out here near where I live, there's an organization called the Orca Network that monitors particularly the orcas, but they have information about lots of whaling situations. There was a man named Paul Sponge from Orca Lab in Canada who was down in St. Kitts, and he had some reports on the Orca Network about the conference down there. And you know, our orca whales out here in Puget Sound are just barely maintaining their numbers. They're also very toxic. Often the firstborn of the mother dies because of the overload of toxins that get offloaded on the baby through the mother's milk. They don't capture them anymore. There was a horrible capture up here in Penn Cove for the SeaWorld type trade. If people would just not go to SeaWorld, that would make a huge difference.
Yeah.
If people realize that those animals do not live, they give them the same name over and over, but they're in these little tanks. There's one named Lolita who's in Florida who was captured up here in Penn Cove. She's the only one remaining. When they did that, they killed some babies.
Mm-hmm.
It was a horrible situation. She's the only one still living, and she should not be in that little tank in Florida. There are people who've been working for years to try to get her reunited with her pod out here in Puget Sound. It probably isn't going to happen. We all wish it would, but there are
okay. Well, Rebecca,
interest.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you for your passion for the whales, and thanks for getting in touch with us. I appreciate you passing along that info.
Thank you for having it on.
My pleasure. Now we've got another Rebecca listening on KPTK in Seattle in Edmonds, Washington. Hello, Rebecca. You're on the air.
Hello there. First, I want to add my condolences to the others. Tom's father raised a wonderful son.
Yes, he did.
And I just want to talk about, you know, you earlier mentioned that it's your theory that the NSA or our government has spying programs that are way beyond what we know about.
Mm-hmm.
And I heard someone say, and I do agree with this, it's very likely that the reason we're not hearing more from our elected representatives and senators is that they know that the NSA and or whatever programs are in existence have all the information about them, everything, that they know everything about their public and private lives. And maybe they feel threatened or intimidated, or maybe they're sort of being blackmailed in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you think?
I would not be surprised, because this is an administration that is ruthless and will use every available means. And they also don't feel that they're going to get caught. I mean, here we have a president who freely admitted that he authorized the NSA spying program without going through the law, the FISA law, and the FISA courts. It's explicit. There's no wiggle room there. And he essentially has challenged the Democrats on the Hill to rein him in. And you may have a point that if he's got dirt on them, that it makes it much more difficult for them to speak freely and challenge these abuses of power.
So a solution would be for people, everybody who can and will, write to as many senators and representatives as possible and say to them that we believe, we see this, or we believe that this is true. And if it's not true of you, if you have nothing to hide, would you please speak out? Or even if you do, that this is not going to resolve itself unless more of our elected people start really fighting back.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to say I also am very interested in the whales, and we do have two baby orcas up here, which is in the L pod, which is very exciting, and
mm-hmm.
that's a completely different subject. But thank you for having the whale expert on, and Katrina Vandenhuvel. I really admire them both. So
yeah, I really admire Katrina Vandenhuvel.
I do too. I dream of taking the nation cruise, the cruise with all of those wonderful people. So thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca. Good to hear from you. And that concludes another hour of the Tom Hartman program. Thanks for listening. Thanks for calling. We're going to do it again for another hour, and we'll be joined right after the news by Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink for Peace. Together with Cindy Sheehan, they are launching a hunger strike at the White House starting on July the 4th. We'll have the details for you coming up right here on the Tom Hartman program. From San Francisco, I'm Peter B. Collins.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Calling for a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded, here's Tom Hartman.
I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom Hartman again today. Lines are open if you'd like to talk with us at 866-440-THOM. A new effort to bring peace to Iraq, a hunger strike.
Are the world watched in horror to hijack planes. Destroyed our trade center. You better believe it. You better deal with it. It's time to keep it in check.
That is the late Yoko Ono with a little updated version of Give Peace a Chance, 2004. Cindy Sheehan and friends have not given up trying to get their message across to President Bush and his administration. Medea Benjamin joins us. She's co-founder of Code Pink for Peace and also Global Exchange, a human rights group based in San Francisco. Medea, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program today.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Nice to talk with you. And tell us a little bit about the plans for this hunger strike or fast that is going to be launched on July 4th in front of the White House.
Well, we just felt like we had to do more, and that July 4th was a day to reflect on the principles on which our nation was founded, and it was founded on rebelling against unrepresentative government, against policies that were considered unjust at that time, and we think it's a time to deepen our commitment against unjust policies in this war in Iraq. So there are a group of us that decided to do a open-ended fast and then ask other people to join us in solidarity, and the response has been incredible. I think we have over 1,500 people who are joining in some portion of the fast. We're starting it in D.C., but people are doing it in their home communities. There's probably about two dozen cities where people are going to do a rolling fast in a public place. And we have fasters in 18 different countries.
Wow, this is great. And when you call a rolling fast, does that mean it's kind of a tag team thing? I fast for a day and then hand off to a friend?
Yeah, that looks like how it's going to be in some of the other cities. In D.C., we're going to have a group of long-term fasters. That includes myself, Diane Wilson, an environmentalist from Texas, a Franciscan
sure.
priest, Father Louis Vitale. We have Dick Gregory, the civil rights activist, Cindy Sheehan, and I think one of the Iraq War veterans, Jeffrey Millard, and a group of Iraqis who are going to be joining us. So I think in D.C. we'll have people that have committed to at least a two-week fast, but some will go longer than that. And then the rolling fast, yes, is each person taking 24 hours.
Mm-hmm. Danny Glover has signed up, Sean Penn, Susan Sarandon, Michael Fronte, one of my favorite musicians who fronts the band called Spearhead. They make great music with powerful political themes. And if people want to get involved, do you want them to go to a website and sign up? What's the protocol here?
Yes, there's a great new website we've created called Troops Home Fast. And on that site, you can see why we're doing the fast, what we hope to accomplish by it. You can sign up for a one-day solidarity fast, and you can see all the other people who have signed on. You've just read out some of them, but every day we get new people. I heard today we have Graham Nash joining us. We have Peter from Peter, Paul, and Mary. We have
Peter Yarrow. Uh-huh.
Peter Yarrow, who is quite old and still at it and very enthusiastic about participating. We have a lot of religious leaders, like the head of the National Council of Churches, Bob Edgar, a number of priests and people of different faith backgrounds. So it's really gaining a lot of momentum. We also have as one of our long-term fasters is Anne Wright, the colonel and former diplomat who resigned, Ray McGovern, former CIA analyst, and people from the Muslim community, like the head of the American Muslim Voice, the head of the National Congress of Black Women. And so I think it's really something that people feel like we should take this opposition to this war to another level. And there will be many things that people can do to support the fasters, not just a one-day solidarity fast, but as we progress in this fast, we'll be asking people to do things like sign on to the Voters Pledge for Peace, that you'll only vote for peace candidates, and get 100 of your friends and colleagues to do the same, introduce a peace resolution into your city council. There will be a commitment to join the week of mass actions against the war, September 21st. So if you sign up on our fasting list, you'll be getting updates from us on all kinds of different things you can do to support this effort.
And again, the website, troopshomefast.org. Thank you. That was the part I didn't write down. We're talking with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink for Peace. Their website is codepink4peace.org. And there's an item that you wrote published on Alternet and truthout.org, perhaps other sites, just in the last few hours. And you describe the efforts by the new fledgling Iraqi government to cut the puppeteer strings, the marionette strings, and develop its own reconciliation plan. And you cite that many Iraqis, Iraqi citizens in a poll, Iraqi leaders, including those who met directly with the president when he made his six-hour photo op sneak trip to Baghdad a couple of weeks ago, that by and large, they all have a unified voice that they want the U.S. occupying force out of Iraq. And as you describe here, we have a couple of wrinkles in the process. What are the big issues in terms of trying to get everybody on the same page in agreement with Iraqis that it's time for the U.S. to get out of their country?
Well, I'm just amazed that this isn't huge news in the media in this country, that the United States has really taken what was a very comprehensive and serious plan to start bringing peace to Iraq and taken out two of the essential components of it. One is that the people who have taken up arms against the U.S. have said, look, part of any peace plan has to be a withdrawal of U.S. troops. Well, the U.S. pressured the Iraqi government to take that key component out of the peace plan. The other was amnesty for fighters. At a war's end, you give amnesty to fighters. And in this case, it was the Democrats in Congress who started saying, how can they even consider giving amnesty to people who have fought against U.S. soldiers? That's an outrage. And forced a vote that passed condemning that. So here are the Republicans refusing to give a timeline and the Democrats refusing to agree to amnesty. And with these two key components taken out of the plan, it's not much of a plan anymore.
Well, and we also are kind of whiplashed right now, Medea, because we saw the debate on the Senate floor last week. Those who supported the Levin resolution, which had no specific date and was non-binding on the president, they got 39 votes, but they were labeled cut and run, the buzz phrase that's been tested by the Republican pollsters and apparently does gain some traction there. But we did see this very mixed message of the Republicans pushing back, saying that calling for a date and calling for drawdown of U.S. troops is unpatriotic and supports the enemy. Well, then General Casey went public over the weekend on his plans to do just what the Democrats have suggested needs to be done.
Exactly. I mean, I think this is the time for the Democrats to stand up and say, we're trying to create democracy in Iraq. Listen to the Iraqis. 87% of them say they want a timeline for withdrawal. The president of Iraq, the vice president of Iraq, the national security advisor of Iraq, listen to what they're saying. There was a timeline for elections. There was a timeline for a constitution. There's got to be a timeline for withdrawal of U.S. troops. It's the only way that there's going to be a serious effort on the part of the Iraqis. So I agree with you. And General Casey came forward and said, you know, here's how we want to deploy the combat brigades out of Iraq. Here's the numbers we want to get out at each date. So the Republicans are sending a very mixed message, but the Democrats aren't picking up on it and saying not only are U.S. generals planning for this, but the Iraqi people are calling for it.
And additionally, I don't think the Democrats are putting up enough of a fuss over the way the Republicans simply deleted the proposals from both the Senate and the House that were attached to the defense supplemental for Iraq that banned permanent bases in Iraq. That language was deleted, and nobody has shown us, you know, how that occurred. It did not occur according to the protocols of the Senate, and thus I believe it's an illegal act. But not hearing enough about that from the Democrats. Medea, thank you for joining us today. Thanks for your advocacy. And we'll be watching and participating in the fast that starts on July 4th. Go to troopshomefast.org and get full information.
Thanks
Medea Benjamin
so much.
From Code Pink, thanks for joining us. I'm Peter B. Collins on the Tom Hartman Program.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
You've got the Tom Hartman Program coming out of your radio or those little speakers in your computer. And I'm Peter B. Collins sitting in for Tom. He'll be back with you tomorrow here on all of these same stations. My lines are open for the rest of this hour. You can talk about any issue in the news that you care about, that you think other people are interested in, give us a call. 866-440-THOM. That's 866-440-8466, toll free. And Pam in Lakewood, Washington, has been holding forever. Hello, Pam, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to let you know, well, I wanted to kind of get back to that gerrymandering and hardball question you put to us earlier.
Yeah, do you think the Democrats should embrace Tom DeLay's tactics and where they control the legislature and the governorship in a state just ram through a purely partisan map?
Right, which isn't to say that we haven't done our share of that in the past, but what I was going to point out was that while I feel like we should be playing a hardball, because I worry that pretty soon, if we don't, all avenues to regaining any power, including suppressing the media, are going to be cut off to us. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
But, I was pointing out to Dan, there was an article in the New York Times today, an editorial, that was talking about this gerrymandering decision that they just made regarding Texas and DeLay. Mm-hmm. And they're saying that the court since Bush v. Gore is showing a pretty strong partisanship along party lines regarding, you know, decisions coming down on these gerrymandering issues in favor of the Republicans more than the Democrats in the cases that have come up.
Mm-hmm.
So it may be that that's not an avenue that we can pursue, because they may not support us in that, and it's because the court is increasingly getting more conservative.
Well, I mean, it would be interesting to see. One of the things that the Times editorial points out is that the court has failed to establish a standard or a test to determine if the gerrymandering was too partisan or based too much or entirely on partisan considerations. And that if the court were to do that, then there would be a standard for lower courts to enforce. And this vagueness suggests to me that, Pam, along the lines of what you just described, if Democrats use the same kind of ruthless tactics to gerrymander states that the Republicans did in Texas, and I do acknowledge that Democrats have used heavy-handed map drawing in the past. I'm not saying that Democrats are innocent, but in the current context, we see the Republicans, because of their willingness to really push the limits of the law and their certainty that a Republican-dominated Supreme Court won't overrule these kinds of measures. It'll be interesting to see if Democrats do it in the future and it rises to the Supreme Court level, if they can then create a test that detects something that is excessively partisan in developing these congressional maps.
Right. Well, I certainly think that it would be worth a try, and that we're at a point where we can't really leave any stone unturned in terms of what we should be trying, and that in this article they don't say why they struck down the Democratic redistricting in Georgia. It's unconstitutional, and yet didn't see one in Texas and in another place.
Yeah, the one in Georgia, I believe, was related to the Voting Rights Act and minority representation.
The one in Georgia, they don't say anything about why they struck down the one in Georgia. It's unconstitutional. So I don't know. I mean, you know, that I think, like I say, I think any stone is, I mean, any way is worth trying right now, because I think they are so ruthless and so willing to do whatever it takes, and we're so not, that if we don't start being, even though I would like us to remain ethical while we do it, I think that we ought to hit them in from every direction we can.
Mm-hmm. And, all right, Pam. And I appreciate your thoughts, and I tend to agree with you. And I'd like to hear some other opinions. 866-440-THOM. That's 866-440-8466. Tell us what you think. Should Democrats, given the Supreme Court ruling, now adopt these tactics or readopt these tactics in some states where Democrats have done this before? It's time for the fictional portion of our broadcast day here on the Tom Hartman Program. And we bring you the latest dispatch from Andy Borowitz, available to you at BorowitzReport.com.
Don't believe me about each other. Not a word.
And today's Borowitz Report reads, U.S. threatens to launch Ann Coulter toward North Korea. Rabid pundit could destroy entire Korean peninsula, U.N. warns. In an act of retaliation for North Korean President Kim Jong-il's plan to test a long-range missile that could reach California, the United States today threatened to launch conservative pundit Ann Coulter in the direction of North Korea. President Bush announced the plan to weaponize Ms. Coulter in a nationally televised address. If North Korea intends to test the most deadly weapon in its arsenal, we will have no alternative but to use the most deadly weapon in ours, and that weapon is Ann Coulter. Mr. Bush didn't indicate how and when Coulter would be fired toward Pyongyang, but most military experts believe she's already been loaded onto a nuclear submarine and could be launched at any moment. At the United Nations, an emergency session of the Security Council was convened to discourage the U.S. from deploying Coulter, who is seen by many in the international community as the ultimate doomsday weapon. Fears abound that if Ms. Coulter were fired toward Pyongyang, she would spew noxious fumes that could lay waste to the entire Korean peninsula, might even destroy Japan and parts of China. A spokesperson for Coulter today acknowledged her client had the power to destroy large areas of Asia and said she was stoked about the mission. I'm Peter B. Collins, here on the Tom Hartman Program. Your calls are next.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Time after, sometimes you picture me. I'm walking too far ahead. You're calling to me. I can't hear what you've said. Then you said.
One of my favorite Cyndi Lauper tunes, Time After Time. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in here again today on the Tom Hartman Program. Tom will be back with you tomorrow. And I'm glad to be here under difficult circumstances for Tom and his family. They're grieving after the loss of Tom's father, Carl Hartman, last weekend. And so you'll probably find a slightly subdued Tom Hartman behind the microphone tomorrow. But any day now, when you ask him how he is, he'll tell you, great, but I'll get better. I know it might take him a little while to get there. 866-440-THOM. We've got lines open right now. Toll free at 1-866-440-8466. I'd love to hear your comments on the gerrymandering decision from the Supreme Court yesterday. You know, I deeply disagree with that. But the court did it again today and actually voted in the direction that I support. It was a 5-3 decision with Chief Justice Roberts abstaining or recusing himself, because in the case of Hamdan versus Rumsfeld, Chief Justice Roberts ruled on that on the appeals court within hours or days of being approached by the Bush administration for the nomination, first as a justice, later upgraded to Chief Justice. So I appreciate that he did operate in a high ethical standard and recuse himself. It's Justice Alito whose recusal passed, his practices of recusal in the past, came into serious question during his confirmation. But in this 5-3 ruling, the court issued a sharp rebuke to President Bush for the manner in which he is planning to try the detainees at Guantanamo Bay. And here's a quote from Michael Ratner, the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York. They have been front and center defending the rights of these detainees. And he says, the Supreme Court has firmly rejected President Bush's attempt to sidestep American courts. Now the president must act. Try our clients in lawful U.S. courts or release them. The game is up. There is no way for President Bush to continue hiding behind a purported lack of judicial guidance to avoid addressing the illegal and immoral prison in Guantanamo Bay. Significantly, the court decided that the Geneva Conventions do apply to the so-called war on terror. People must be treated humanely, and the administration cannot put itself above the law. We are gratified that the court accepted our argument that fundamental human rights are protected by the Geneva Conventions, and this decision vindicates our 5-year legal struggle. Hamdan, as you may know, was alleged to be Osama bin Laden's driver. And I don't know if he is one of the quote-unquote bad guys that Bush maintains are the only kind of people we've sent to Guantanamo Bay. I take deep umbrage when people like Chris Matthews on television repeatedly use the term bad guys to, without defining it, refer to just a murky group of people who oppose us. And I'm sorry, but using the term bad guys is not journalism. It is not reporting. And it is really implying that you simply accept the assertion of the Bush administration that all these people at Guantanamo are bad guys. Well, if they're bad guys, put them on trial, convict them, and throw the book at them. Lock them up forever, or, you know, I don't support capital punishment, but if that's the law and that's where you want to go, I prefer that to this, you know, interminable detention without charges, without access, without communication. It is fundamentally inhumane and un-American, and I do not support it in any way. Lines are open if you'd like to talk with me. 866-440-TOM, 866-440-8466. We go to Keith in Kent, Washington. Hi, Keith. You're on the air.
Hi, Peter. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, I hate it when you say that. Thanks for holding on until I got to your call, Keith.
I'd like to talk about gerrymandering, but first an aside about Chris Matthews. And inarticulation in the press is not casual. It's purposeful. For example, calling George Bush the, quote, commander-in-chief, unquote, when he is essentially the figurehead commander-in-chief of the armed forces. He's not a bureau. He's not a figurehead. He's merely the president. It is a balance of power among the various branches of government. Clearly, and we're aware of this. So regarding gerrymandering, I was talking with your screener about the idea that since the legislatures will no longer be anything but partisan in how they address these issues, it seems the best way to address it would be for communities such as Austin, Texas, to begin class action suits that claim that their democratic representation has been breached because the community no longer has an identity in terms of federal representation because it's been divided into so many pieces. Just an idea.
Well, I'm not qualified legally to offer you any feedback on whether that's a meaningful distinction that the court would acknowledge. I just don't know that.
And I don't know whether or not there's any mechanism by which local, municipal, county, or state governments can address issues of a federal nature, but it seems more and more the Democrats are the ones on the side of states' rights in terms of having representation of our concerns at the federal level.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly.
Well, the one thing I'll say is that in the decision that was handed down yesterday, the court generally upheld the Texas redistricting process. They did disallow the lines in one district because they said those lines did violate the Voting Rights Act, and it was, I believe, an attempt to create a district that actually was kind of extra loaded with Latino voters. So I don't know the specifics of that to comment intelligently, but it was a part of the ruling. So perhaps that's something that can be addressed. To your other question, local and county governments have no say in redistricting, except to the extent to which they can lobby their legislative representatives.
And I sense that the clear issue for Democrats and independents and progressives is to speak among themselves, get out the vote, and follow the process so that votes are counted, and clearly assume that their representation will only be meaningful if they take part in the process. And that's a tough nut to crack.
Yeah. All right, Keith, thank you for your call today.
Thanks.
Good to talk with you. Next, we go to Maple Valley, Washington. Jim's on the line. Hello, Jim. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B.
Hi, Peter. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Good. Say, the reason I called, I read in the Seattle PI this morning that yesterday the House of Representatives overturned a law that was passed a couple of years ago requiring that all handguns sold have trigger locks on them. And setting that law aside, to me, makes absolutely no sense, especially when you consider safety issues with children and such. And just this spring, there were quite a few schools that were concerned about the shootings like they had back during the Columbine event.
Right. Well, I can't explain that ruling because
there's no explanation for it.
Yeah, it certainly seems very clear to me that putting a trigger lock is a safety measure that does not inhibit one's expression under the Second Amendment.
Right.
So I don't get that,
that's
but I'll look into
to
it.
Me.
Yeah, I'd love to see the ruling. Now, did the court offer a ruling or just dismiss it without explanation?
This wasn't the court. This was supposedly the House of Representatives that set aside the law.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Well, I'll look into that. I didn't see that story so far.
Yeah. I have one more item here I wanted to mention, too.
Okay.
You recall back in January, the body armor issue with the Marines?
Sure.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. Go ahead.
Well, in any case, the only senator that I know of that's pursuing that matter is Hillary Clinton. And I'm really surprised that more of the people here in the Senate that say they support the troops aren't pursuing that issue.
Senator Cher Bono has been actually pretty active in trying to raise the issue about helmets and other protective gear for our troops.
Has he ordered an investigation through the GAO?
I don't know that.
That's one thing Clinton has going right now. So I think everybody should applaud her, but the other senators should get off their duffs and do something there.
All right. Jim, thank you for the call today.
You betcha. Bye now.
Good to talk with you. And you can join us here on the Tom Hartman Program, 866-440-THOM, 866-440-8466. And earlier this hour, I played a little music by Yoko Ono, an updated version of Give Peace a Chance. And it appears that I misspoke because I referred to her as the late Yoko Ono. And for some reason, I thought she had passed away. And during a break, I looked her up on Wikipedia, and apparently she is alive and well. And Yoko Ono, I must apologize and issue this correction.
Excuse me.
Joe, in Brookings, Oregon, you're live on the Tom Hartman Program.
Yeah, well, the Supreme Court ruled on that case in Texas about the gerrymandering. I believe that Tom DeLay should already be sitting in prison over that. I mean, he tried to use the Homeland Department, try and throw those legislators.
He tried to trace the tail number of a plane that was flown by one of the renegade Democrats who left Texas to deny the Republicans a quorum so that legally they could not proceed with the legislation to initiate the remapping in Texas.
Yep. Well, yeah. The commercial coming up, can I comment a little bit more about it?
Yeah, Joe, we're going to bring you back after the break. So you hold on. We'll return in just a moment. And there's room for more calls between now and the top of the hour. Give me a buzz. 866-440-THOM or 866-440-8466, toll free. You can email me, Peter, at peterbcollins.com. We'll continue in a moment here on the Tom Hartman Program.
925.32 and save $375 on select styles. Offer ends 7/29/06. License number available upon request, not available in all areas. See associate or ask your consultant for written limited warranty details. If it's time to replace your windows, call Sears now, 1-800-349-2532. That's 1-800-349-2532.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time.
It's the Tom Hartman Program. I'm Peter B. Collins, sitting in for Tom. He'll be back tomorrow, so I hope you'll greet him warmly when he returns. There's room for your call if you'd like to join me at 866-440-8466. That's 1-866-440-THOM. And we go back to Joe in Brookings, Oregon. Joe, you're back on the air. Go right ahead, sir.
Yeah, well, you know, here in the United States, we have this ridiculous problem with the gerrymandering, with the crooked major political parties. They don't have this sort of problem in Europe. They don't have partisan people drawing up the legislative districts. They don't have partisan people counting up the votes, and they don't have the problem with crooked elections like we have over in this country.
You know what's interesting, Joe? The other day here on the Hartman Program, I interviewed Spencer Overton, who is a law professor in Washington and the author of a new book about our stolen democracy. And he was on the NewsHour on PBS last night, and he made an interesting point. He said, in Iraq, the districts are drawn by an independent commission, not by the new legislative group, the parliament, that has been impaneled there. I just thought that was an interesting little side note.
Well, yeah, one way we could start is to make the state legislatures nonpartisan. They already are nonpartisan in a few states. Make them nonpartisan in all the states, and maybe that would help with having the districts be drawn up in a nonpartisan manner. Because the Democrats are going along with the game the way it's being played now. The fact of the matter is they don't know how to play the game as good as the Republicans know how to play the game, and that's why they're losing. They're probably going to continue.
I think that's a fair criticism.
Yeah. And I think it's disgraceful, California, in the name of trying to punish Arnold Schwarzenegger last year, defeated Measure 77. I thought that was a good thing. I would trust a Common Cause's opinion on that sort of thing more than certain talk show hosts supporting the Democratic Party and Democratic Party itself. We need to get rid of this partisan way of counting up the votes and drawing up the legislative districts.
I take your point. And in general, I did support the redistricting measure in California last year, but it, like Texas, was a mid-decade plan. And it also was convoluted in the manner in which the panel, that drew the maps was selected. So, I think the right thing by rejecting all of Arnold's initiatives. And there is a move to put a new redistricting plan on the ballot. It could be as early as this year. So people are paying attention to that. And I hope that it will be fixed for the next cycle. I just hope so. Thanks a lot for your call. Now to Davis, California. Claire is on the line. Hi, Claire. You're on the air.
The Democrats don't know how to play the game as well as the Republicans. The Democrats are still using moral fiber to make their decisions, which the Republicans have ceased to do.
Well, you're right about that. But do we want to emulate that type of behavior on the Republicans? I mean, in general, I think we have to put our helmets on and really play as hard as they play. On the other hand,
but with morals.
Yes, I would like to maintain a basic moral standard because It's hard to claim victory when you know it's tainted.
I'm not interested in tainted victory. I'm only interested in real democracy.
Okay. I'm with you, Claire.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for checking in today. This portion of the Tom Hartman program is brought to us by Naked Airlines.
I used to fly with my clothes on till the airline clothing banned. We went from scanning to banning. One airline had tanning, and this was the ad they ran. Fly safe, fly naked, no weapons to find. You're safer with nothing on. Naked Airlines.
That is the official airline for me. I play this song because it illustrates, I think, the way the average American experiences the so-called war on terror. And that is, we have delays at airports. It's ridiculous to see grandmothers and moms with three kids being treated like they're planning to hijack a plane. But that has been the experience of most people in terms of the tightened security after 9/11. The Center for American Progress in Washington, together with it's a foreign policy review. They did a study that was released last week, Foreign Policy Magazine. Thank you. And they surveyed 100 leading experts on terrorism in our country. And let me just give you a couple of quick stats, and I'm going to refer only to the conservatives whom they polled. 81% said the world is becoming more dangerous for the United States. 71% disagreed with Bush that the U.S. is winning the war on terrorism, whatever that phrase means. 69% of conservatives said the Iraq war has had a negative impact on U.S. security. 68% rated U.S. intelligence reform since 9/11 as fair or poor. 64% said there's no chance or a low likelihood of an attack on the scale of September 11th by the end of 2006. 82% said such an attack is likely or certain by the end of 2011. And 86% said such an attack is certain by the end of 2016. Well, what you get is that even conservatives strongly believe that the United States is losing this struggle. Even though the Bush administration spins it in the manner they do and tries to make it appear otherwise, we're losing. And that's disappointing, discouraging. We got a lot of work to do. I want to thank you for listening the last few days as I've been sitting in for Tom Hartman. Tom returns tomorrow and takes back the reins of his program. I'll talk to you up the road. I'm Peter B. Collins. Visit my website, peterbcollins.com.